Okay, so today I'm on the Skype with Mark Roden in Melbourne, Australia. Thanks very much for agreeing to talk to us today, Mark. Can you describe what it is you do for a living?
Sure, I'm a punter, a race analyst, and I sell a subscription service as well. So they're all interlinked. The analysis leads to the punting and the tipping, I suppose. But yes, it's all racing and punting focused.
Okay, so you told me that your father was a serious semi-professional punter. What how did he operate? How much did you learn from him?
Quite a lot, actually. He was a school teacher, but he bet quite seriously on the side and used it as a source of income rather than a hobby. He was influenced by a man called Don Scott, who wrote a series of books in the 70s and 80s out here in Australia, basically outlined his theories on rating horse performance using weight primarily. And that influenced an awful lot of people, and my father was one of them. And then he used what he'd learned from those books, added a time element to it, which he'd learned from another source, and then started keeping his own ratings on Melbourne horse racing. It was he was focusing on in those days, and he used that to price and bet on racing, and did it quite successfully for a couple of decades.
Was that something that you got interested in as to what he was up to from an early age?
A very early age. According to my mother, my first words were "they're racing," so it was going to be pretty hard for me to get away from it, it appears. But you know, as a small child, I was just interested in the sport. I really loved the sport, but I was taken by the betting side of it from a young age too. And I suppose having that example of my father as a successful punter, because he won every year. I think he won every year by one for about 20 years when he was betting seriously. That certainly piqued my interest that this could be something I might want to do at some stage along the track as well.
And was he happy to sort of impart his knowledge, or was he a bit worried that his son might become a serious punter?
It doesn't appear so. He's actually joked in more recent times that his method of parenting would probably be frowned upon in more modern times. But I used to go to the races with him. I was going every week with him, but from the age of about 12, every Saturday at least. So no, he certainly didn't discourage me in any way, and he taught me a great deal, especially as I got into my teens and I wanted to take it a bit more seriously and learn some of the techniques that he used. Yes, he gave me a great deal of help.
Okay, so that leads me nicely on to my next question. I was going to ask you where he plied his trade. So he was an on-course punter, was he?
Yes. He had to work during the week, so he'd occasionally be having bets off course at the TABs we have out here during the week. But there were very, very few Saturdays he wasn't at one of the four metropolitan tracks down here in Melbourne.
Okay, so you started to work for on-course bookmakers from quite an early age. Was that a natural progression from going to the races and meeting these guys?
Yes, it was that I had some friends who were getting some work with bookmakers as well. That sort of pushed me into it. After high school, I went to university and started an arts degree, majoring in English and history, which is quite a different path from the one I ended up adopting. But after I left university, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. Like a lot of people, I suppose, at that age, I had a series of more or less menial jobs that didn't really excite me that much. I was working part-time at the races and just waiting for something to come along, I suppose.
How many courses would there be that you could work at in your area at that time?
Well, there's the four tracks actually in Melbourne and its suburbs, but there were, I couldn't tell you exactly how many, but 15 or 20 within 1 or 2 hours of Melbourne in the car as well. So when I was working for bookmakers, it was occasionally in the city, but quite a lot of them were country and provincial meetings, 1 to 2 hours out of Melbourne. But yeah, even in the 90s, there would have been 6, 7 days a week of racing. So there was, plenty of opportunities to ply the trade.
Okay, so you came from a background where your father was a successful punter. I'm assuming you were quite successful as well, sort of learning from him. What did you learn about punters when you started working for bookmakers? Were you quite surprised how some of them used to carry on?
I don't know. I think because I've been going to racetracks from such a young age, I was pretty au fait with how punters behaved. And I certainly wasn't a successful punter straight away as a younger man. I was a lot less disciplined, I'd have to say. It took me a while to get a handle on that sort of thing. Yeah, when I was working, it was just more of the same, really, when I was working for Bookmakers on Track, because to me, the racetrack was such a natural environment to me. I've been to, if I was going to the races 40, 50, 60 or more times a year from the age of about 12, I was pretty used to it. And yeah, when I started working for bookies, there wasn't much the punters could throw at me that would surprise me, I suppose.
Were there many punters on course that you would describe as professionals that used to beat you all the time? Overtime, I should say.
Yeah. Some of the bookmakers I worked for were smaller, so they were doing all in their power to sort of avoid that sort of business and play the more recreational end. I'd say if you're going to the track on a Wednesday or a Thursday, for instance, at one of the provincial meetings, and there were guys there betting in big sums in cash, you could be pretty sure that they weren't doing it for fun. And they, in the smaller crowds you'd have midweek, they'd obviously stand out more. At the weekend meetings and the big carnival meetings, you'd have massive crowds on track. And I probably would have been working in a ring that was either on a front lawn or out the back somewhere, just dealing with the fivers and tenors and the small recreational end of it. But those professional guys certainly stood out at the small meetings at the quieter times of the year.
Okay, so then you started a 17-year career with what you describe as corporate bookmakers. Why did you go in that direction rather than try and follow a career on course?
I think by the late 90s, there wasn't enough work to just keep working on track as any sort of career. It was, I think there were very few, even then, full-time. There would have been only a handful of full-time bookmaker staff, clerks who could do it 5 or 6 times a week and make a good enough living. I would have struggled to get more than 2 or 3 days work a week, and obviously had to do another full-time job as well. And yeah, the opportunity to move to Darwin came up, and at the age I was, which was about 24, and not having an established career in anything really that I wanted to do down in Melbourne, to have an opportunity come up in horse racing, which was my great passion, was a no-brainer. It was just too good to pass up, I thought.
So what was your first role?
Well, it was pretty clerical, and it was not particularly high paying either. So I got a job with a company called IAS in Darwin, which was one of, if not the first, the second, what I'd call corporate bookmaker, which is a bookmaker just like you'd know them in the UK, off the course. And in those days, bookmakers in Victoria and New South Wales and the other states weren't even allowed to be partnerships. They were sole traders and had to be on the course. So there was different legislation in the Northern Territory where Darwin's situated, and this is where companies could take bookmaking licences. Anyway, IAS was one of the early ones of those, started by a guy called Mark Reed, who'd been a very successful bookmaker and punter on both sides of the fence in Melbourne and Sydney through the 80s and 90s. But he'd seen the writing on the wall as to which way the on-course bookmaking industry was heading. He'd been held huge sums of money betting on the rails in Melbourne and Sydney, but he could sense by the mid-90s that it was drying up and that he had to evolve if he wanted to be as successful as he, to continue to be as successful as he had been. He was going to have to make a move. And he got a license in the Northern Territory and away he went. And I entered an ad in the paper, basically got a very much a clerical role at first, which was basically answering phones and entering bets in the machine. And that kind of thing, as I said, for not a great wage either. But after, it was only a matter of a couple of weeks that I, not that I got sick of that, but it was, I wanted something a bit more engaging and fulfilling. So I just started pestering people, asking if I could give them any help with their analysis or trading or that kind of thing. That they had a room full of racing analysts up there in Darwin who priced all the meetings around Australia. And I just managed to get my foot in the door with those guys and pestered enough people that they started giving me small roles to do some small country meetings and that kind of thing. And it took off from there.
Okay, that sort of leads me right on to the next thing you told me, that you learned the game inside out, bookmaking, trading and punting from some great mentors. Can you tell us the biggest lessons you learned and from who, if you like? What were the most important things they taught you?
Yeah, okay. Well, it was wide ranging. The two main people I learned from in that era were the boss, Mark Reed, and he probably his main, his chief analyst, a guy called Jared Toomey, who taught me a hell of a lot. And a lot of people who came through IAS at that time would say the same thing. He knew the game backwards. He was a tremendous teacher. As to what specifically, IAS had a method of form analysis, which was their own. They had their own database. They were very big on watching video replays. So you're sort of trained from scratch how to do the form that, and assess races their way. You know, it was very much done in a standardized way. There was room for individual input, but there was rules you had to follow. I thought I had a pretty good handle on how to approach it, but you know, once you start doing it, it's then that you realize how little you really do know. And I was basically starting from scratch, but I picked it up reasonably quickly, I think, which was great. And it was due to the assistance I got from those guys, but also being around an environment like that, where you're 6 or 7 days a week just surrounded by other people talking racing all the time, talking form analysis, talking pricing, betting, just being immersed in the environment. I'd say within 6 to 12 months, I'd learned an awful lot, which really was enough to kick me off on my career.
Okay, so I'm assuming that they were doing all that work to price up races accurately, to take punters on head on. Now, would that have totally become irrelevant with the advent of the exchanges?
It's certainly less relevant. In fact, I would say that's why I was made redundant at the end of 2016, and it's because I was basically an old school form analyst and pricer, and the need for people like me was just less and less important as time went on. But that's the very end compared to the very start. The interesting thing about IAS is they punted as well. They priced races to have an accurate market to bet to when they're taking on the punters, but if we had a view that was different from the market as to the price of the horse, especially a favourite, that we would go and back it ourselves. Not just lay off the bets we'd taken sometimes, especially if, say, a smart punter had backed one of these horses and we thought the price was good, we'd lay off his money and go with them for something as well, which was a very aggressive way of trading. It was fairly rare, I think, especially among corporates. And it's almost unknown now, or totally unknown now, I would say.
Was it an eye-opener to you how many punters were very clever and used to win? I mean, did winning punters get accommodated?
Absolutely. Back in the late 90s, early 2000s, yeah, it was almost a point of pride that we would... they couldn't get on for whatever they wanted at any time, but they would be... If we'd quoted a price, we were sort of duty-bound to give them a decent bet. And so, depending on our opinion of the horse, that could mean to lose up to... $20,000-$30,000 or more, especially in a big meeting like Melbourne Cup Week, it might be even more than that. And this is not to recreational punters with a lot of money, this is to winning punters. And the market was big enough and could absorb enough of our laying off action that it was possible to do now. But the bookies over here have certainly put their shutters up to each other in terms of trading with each other. So that approach has been gone for 5 to 10 years now, I'd say.
And that's gone for the same reason, you think, the betting exchanges?
Yes. I just think the bookmakers now are less inclined to lay off at all, unless they had some massive liability on a multi or something. They'd rather just play the recreational end of the market and let the overround sort it out.
Okay, Mark. So we talked about that you learnt your trade from your father and from the firm you were working for. So you got made redundant in 2016 and you've been punting ever since. I was going to ask if that was a big decision to make, but it was basically made for you. I'm assuming you brought that inside knowledge of form to turn against your, get a poacher turn gamekeeper or vice versa.
Yes, I certainly was using the knowledge I picked up. And it'd been such a long time, 17 years I've been working in form analysis and pricing and trading. I had that knowledge base to start me off. And to be honest, it was the bookmaking industry for me was becoming less and less interesting and exciting for the reasons I mentioned, that as my job was becoming more and more automated, I suppose, it was becoming more clerical in a way, rather than I was having less and less input into pricing and risk management decisions and all of that kind of thing. In a sense, the fun had gone out of it. So I didn't have a clear, roadmap or timeline or anything, but I thought one day I'm going to have to, if I'm going to get the same enjoyment and fulfillment as I got out of the game as when I entered the game, I was going to have to do something different, and that was going to have to be my own. But as you say, the decision was made for me as to the timing. I wasn't expecting that to happen, but once it did, I would say within a month I was giving it a go on my own. So I certainly didn't plan to be punting for a living at the end of 2016. But once that decision was made for me, I had been in some sense prepared for it. So I was ready to go, and there was nothing else I really wanted to do at the age I was at either. So yes, I jumped in.
So you saw that the professional punters that used to be able to get onto lumps were having their wings drastically clipped. Did that not sort of put you off a bit, thinking, how are you going to get? Or did you bring some sort of inside knowledge of the industry to help you get around those problems?
Yes, I'm not going to claim that every bet I've ever had has been under my own name, but the risk departments of the bookmakers are pretty smart. It only takes a handful of bets for you to count and be flagged up these days. That said, we're lucky in Australia, I think, compared to the UK, and then we've got minimum bet limits. So after 9 a.m. on metropolitan racing in Australia, in most states anyway, they have to bet you to lose at least $2,000. So with the range of firms you can get on with, that gives you a bit of leeway. Against that, we're experiencing a bit of consolidation in the market at the moment of late in Australia. So, that's going to be a problem. It's going to get harder and harder to get on. I think the minimum bet laws are a great thing. I just can't see a reason why they're not in place everywhere. It just seems it's not huge sums of money, $2,000, especially on big metropolitan racing. And it's time limited. It doesn't come into place until 9 a.m. on race morning. So I think it's more than fair to the bookmakers, and it does give the punter at least some chance.
I was going to mention, because obviously restricted punters in the UK look with envy at that minimum bet rule in Australia. And I was going to ask, is it as good as it sounds? I mean, do you notice that the margins are a lot bigger at that, as soon as that point comes?
The margins have increased, but I'm not sure. I should point out, I was actually in the industry when the limits first came in, and it didn't impact on our profits at all. I mean, I was working at Sportsbet, which had merged with Paddy Power and then Betfair, which it was a monstrously huge company, with, that held an absolute fortune. But the impact on revenue was negligible, if anything, at our company anyway. It may have been different at other shops, but I didn't see any effect on revenue. What was the original part of your question?
Well, just saying that, the restricted punters in the UK, and there's apparently a lot of them, look with envy at the minimum bet Australian rules. And just wondering if the bookmakers...
Oh, margins, right.
Yeah, the margins are sort of too skinny to make it value.
When I was at Sportsbet, I don't think we added much margin to allow for the introduction of minimum bet limits. The biggest impact on overrounds in early markets in recent times in Australia has been the winding up of fees and taxation on the bookies, both by governments and racing authorities. All the different state racing bodies have imposed race fields fees, which is a bit of a nebulous term, but it's just a way of charging bookmakers. That's quite onerous. They get charged either on turnover or gross profit on a meeting, whichever is the higher. So they could actually have a losing day in the book on a meeting and have to pay a percentage of their hold. But conversely, if they have a big winning day, they'll be charged at something, somewhere between 15 and 30% of their gross profits on the day. So they get them either way. And in addition to that, in the last 2 to 3 years, various state governments have decided they want a piece of the action as well, and have introduced point of consumption tax. So if someone's in Victoria, for instance, and has a bet on any race or sporting event anywhere in the world, because they were physically in Victoria when they had that bet, the bookmaker gets charged, I think it's 8% in Victoria on turnover. So that's just another way in which the screws have been wound up in them, and that's fed into their margin, and they've been quite clever about it too, I think, because they've fed a lot of that extra margin they're putting into their books into the top end of the market, the top three or four chances in each race. I don't think you'll see much impact on the prices of outsiders. A 33-1 chance is still going to be, they'll still bet 33-1 about, but the 2-1 shots they're betting 6-4 about. So they've really funneled a lot of their percentage into that end of the market. That had a big impact on me because I like to back a lot of favourites and had a really good run doing so in 17 and 18, in the early markets in particular, but that avenue is just getting harder and harder to find an edge in.
Okay, so let's talk about your betting. Do you specialise in anything in particular?
Yes, well, it's New South Wales racing, Sydney and New South Wales racing, which is odd because I'm from Melbourne in Victoria. But the reason for that is for the last, I would say, it would have been about 9 or 10 years of my corporate career, I was first for IAS, then Sportsbet, either the head trader or one of the head traders for Sydney Racing. Because when you're in a firm like that, obviously you're assigned a different state. Everyone's assigned a different state to work on. And for me, it was New South Wales for, about 9 years, I think. I was the head trader of New South Wales at Sportsbet for quite a few years. So when the time came to go out on my own, there didn't seem to be any point in changing to betting on Melbourne and Victorian racing just because I live here. I've built up so much experience and knowledge of Sydney racing that's what I wanted to stick with. The disadvantage I'm at is that I can't actually go to the track in Sydney, obviously being Melbourne-based, and I might be disadvantaging myself by not going to the learning the pool of horses down here in Melbourne and actually going to the races and getting all the advantages that brings you as well. But I really like Sydney racing. I'm very comfortable with it, and I'm certainly sticking with it for the foreseeable future.
What would your main focus be? Is it speed figures, form, watching the videos?
All of the above. I keep my own ratings database, which is derived, I suppose you'd call them speed figures. It's time, class and weight, a bit of a blend of the three. So I'm not as strictly chained to time and sectional time as some other people who approach it that way, but it's certainly the cornerstone of the approach. And yes, video analysis is key as well. I think that the ratings and the database are the most important thing because the way I like to do the form, I like to have a number to tie it to at the end of the day. I mean, I like to be quite flexible in how I use those numbers, but when I come to pricing a race, I like to have a number that aligns to something in my database, the way I do it, that gives me something to hang my hat on and a solid foundation to price from.
Okay, so what is the most, to you, the most important aspect of form to take into account when you're looking for a bet?
The single most important is the horse's intrinsic ability. And with my database, I'm confident that I've got a fair handle on what that is or what it potentially is. But that is far from the whole story, obviously. Then you get into issues like pace and speed maps, jockey ability, trainer ability, fitness, just a myriad of form factors that... I think everyone, whether they're doing the form in a more old-fashioned manner like me or they're modelling, it's all about weighting these variables and these different form factors. I probably take a more manual, labour-intensive approach, I suppose, but it's, in a sense, it's the same thing the modellers are doing, their regression theory and so on. And it's just all about weighting variables and how you approach that's up to you. But at the end of the day, it's all about how you come up with a price and if you can find value, I suppose.
Well, that leads me nicely on to my next. Do you price your own races before looking at the actual market?
Yes, I do. Yes. That's not to say I pay no heed to the market, but certainly the first cut is done before I've seen a set of prices, yes.
And that's I assume that's a skill you learned when you were working in Darwin.
Yes, it was. Those books by Don Scott I mentioned before from the 70s and 80s had sort of rudimentary pricing method in it. Probably a bit unfair to say rudimentary. It was very sophisticated for its time. And I'd sort of messed about with that in my teens, around that age, trying to have a go at it, but I didn't have the same ratings or database background or knowledge at that point. So, it was pretty primitive stuff. Of course, when I moved into the bookmaking industry, there's a lot more hanging on it. If you're pricing a race and you're going to go to market and trade based on those set of prices, it's incumbent upon you to get them as right as you can. So, yes, having the decade and a half of experience doing that is certainly standing me in good stead now, I'd say.
And are you confident enough in your own ability that if you see something that's sticking out badly, to take real advantage of it, or do you doubt that maybe you've got it wrong?
I think you have to back yourself in that situation. Naturally, you're not going to be right all the time. But if experience has shown that you're right often enough, and when you do get those big edges, if they have paid dividends for you, then that gives you more confidence the next time that they appear. But, I think second-guessing yourself in that situation is... I think you should be... As I said, the market needs to be respected. To a certain extent, and you shouldn't be too cavalier, but if you're not going to back yourself in a situation where you're confident in your set of prices and there's a big difference, then you might as well not do it, really.
Okay. You mentioned that all the bets that you've ever had aren't always in your name. I mean, has it got to be a bit clandestine, or do you just wait until you can get the lumps on in the morning?
Well, betting in the morning's become less and less lucrative in the Australian marketplace these days, and in a lot of cases, a better waiting until the last 5 minutes when liquidity's up in the exchange, the market's more settled, and the market overround is actually easing a little bit. You know, see, we're sort of dealing with high 120s at 125 to 130% at 9 in the morning, and that will almost always be sub 115 or 16 by start time. So that's a pretty significant difference. And as I said, with them funneling a lot of that extra percentage into the favourites, if you want to back a favourite, in a lot of cases, you're going to have to wait.
We've talked about the good bet, which is winning and making a living gambling. I mean, how do you cope with, I assume even you get them, the inevitable losing run?
Absolutely, I get them. Absolutely, I do. It's experience. I suppose I've experienced them, maybe not losing runs, but I've experienced them in the industry as well. You can have terrible days, and you know, you're, as a trader, you're assessed on your figures. So if you knock off a couple of $100,000 in an afternoon, then that does not reflect well on you, and you have to, you know, cope with it somehow. And then, of course, when you're on working for yourself, it's more important again, because it's your cash. I can't claim to be the sort of person who should be giving anyone advice on how to react psychologically under these circumstances. I think as I've got older, I've got a lot better at it, but I have been known to swear at the television and that kind of thing after close finishes. I actually think that can be helpful as long as you don't let it get out of control. If you just have a quick vent, you know, and it's over within seconds, and you can rebalance, that's okay. But where it can be harmful is if, for instance, if you get a race wrong and it's not bad luck or a close finish and it's just you've made a mistake, the worst thing you can do is dwell on it. Because everyone, aside from the normal run, bad luck you get in racing, everyone makes mistakes as well. If you dwell on that and start talking negatively to yourself or start thinking, oh, I can't do this, I'm not cut out for it, I'm no good, that can get you into a spiral, which is hard to break. I'd like to think I don't do that anymore, but early on, when I was perhaps feeling a bit more pressure, when I was more new to it, that was a problem I had. And I haven't actually, it's something I've done on my own, not something I've gone to, you know, seek counselling for or anything, but I think just the experience of having been there and bounced back from it on more than one occasion has really helped me. And I know that that's not the case, that it's not because I'm, you know, not good enough at it. It's just that I've made a mistake and you just have to let it go. Same as a sportsman, if they miss a, you know, miss an easy goal or easy putt on a golf course or something, if they start dwelling on it and spiraling downwards, it's going to have a much bigger effect than it needs to.
Okay, so is horse racing still a pleasure for you now that you do it for a living?
Yes, it is. Put it this way, I'd rather do this than anything else. It beats working, as they say. But it is a job. You know, you're doing it, watching racing 5, 6, 7 days a week sometimes. It's like anything, it gets to be a grind. So you've got to have other interests and just ways to unwind, I think. But, you know, for all the fact that it does become routine and a bit of a grind, it's still my favourite sport to watch. Always will be, I think, and yes, I'm very, very pleased to be able to make a living watching it and analysing it and betting on it.
Now, you mentioned that one of your coping mechanisms is maybe shouting at the TV if it goes wrong or whatever. Have you ever started to doubt your own ability in the midst of one of those bad runs? And if so, what do you do to have a word with yourself?
Yeah. Once early, I think in my first 6 months, when I first started, I actually started very well the first couple of months. Then I had a losing run. And I just paused for, I don't think it was a week, it was about 3 or 4 days. And I just pulled apart all the bets I've been having, pulled apart my form analysis techniques and just looked at what am I getting right, what am I getting wrong, what am I winning on, what am I losing on. And once you sort of analyse those things, you know, with a bit of distance and a bit more coldly, even if you've been losing overall, you can still point to a few things and say, well, I've been doing this right and this right and this right. And I've actually been winning on this type of race and these types of bets. So that in itself gives you confidence, I think. I haven't actually had to go to that extreme of actually pausing, stopping completely for a few days since. But that certainly helped at that time. As to doubting my own ability, I probably did. I would say I had some doubts to take a measure like that, like stopping for a few days. But once I saw the outcomes of that, that gave me great confidence in myself. And I think that's stood me in good stead.
Okay. Were you a winning punter when you were working for the bookmakers still? Were you using the same tool?
Yes. It's a little different. I don't know if employees have had to do this anymore, but you had access to what all the smartest punters in Australia were backing. And you could either marry that up with your own stuff or just blindly follow them in, as I know a lot of people used to do. I think that's getting harder and harder for them to do that.
Okay, nowadays. Sorry, carry on.
No, go on, yes.
So in the time that you've been pro punter, with the 4 years, people often say that nothing stays the same. You have to keep ahead of the game. So have you had to already adjust your strategy to keep in front?
How have I had to?
No, have you had to? Yeah, have you had to sort of adjust things to stay ahead of the game?
Yeah, I touched on it before. I was having good success it was through 17 and 18, betting the early markets and concentrating on favourites, second favourites, that end of the market anyway. And there seemed to be enough edge to just, you know, it's not going to last forever. Then when a few changes, like the taxation changes came in, margins got tighter, especially early. I tried to stick with what I was doing, and that cost me the edge. I should have realised a bit sooner, really, that the edge that had been there had dried up, and I needed to change. So I have since then changed, and it involves looking wider in the market for value. I think that's, as they've compressed the prices of a lot of the favourites, then little edges have appeared a bit further out in the market, and as I said, also betting later, which is realistically when you, unless there's been an obvious mistake in the early market, that's your best opportunity to get on at a reasonable price, I think.
Okay, so let's talk. Sorry.
I was just going to say that my strategy, the one that I wanted to keep following and backing favourites and horses at that end of the market, has a massive advantage, and that is strike rate, which is great on every level. Not least psychologically. when your runs of outs aren't too long, obviously your confidence isn't going to be dented as much. But if you're having to try and bet in the, you know, 10 to 1 and longer range, you are just naturally going to face longer runs of outs. Of course, the payoffs are greater when you do hit a winner in that price range, but you do have to prepare yourself for longer runs of outs.
Okay, do you operate a staking plan of sorts?
Yeah, it's more or less betting to my assessed price. So, yeah, if I have a horse marked a 6-4 chance, therefore I think it's a 40% chance, then most of the time I'm going to be having twice as much on it as a horse I've assessed 4-1, a 20% chance. So that's basically it. However, I will up the staking if there's a bigger edge. If I think something's a genuine 6-4 chance, and I'm getting 3-1, for instance, I'll probably up the staking as opposed to if I was getting 7-4 or 2-1 that horse. So that's like the Kelly criterion. I don't exactly use Kelly or even a fractional Kelly like a lot of people do, but it's the same theory where I think there is a big edge there, and I'm confident in my price. I should point out there that, you know, not every horse you mark 6-4 is the same, because in some races compared to others, you're going to have more information and more solid grounding for your market. You know, a race full of first starters or 2-year-olds or maidens isn't going to be the same as a, you know, good quality race on a Saturday. So things like that come into it. But if it's a 6-4 shot I'm very confident in, and I can get 3-1 up, that's probably where I'm going to pull the trigger.
What sort of figures are we talking? 2, 3, 4? Your stake for stakes?
Well, you get on to win what you can. You know, you're sort of a bit limited by what the market will stand. So it's in that region, yeah.
Okay. So what do you operate a betting bank? Do you have the, like a tank that you just use? And if so, what sort of percentage of your bank would you be comfortable backing per bet?
It used to be, my maximum used to be 2%, but I've upped that. I would say the absolute maximum would be 4 now, which is quite aggressive, I think. Any more than 4, I think you're sailing a bit close to the wind. But yeah, I'd say, and 4 would be unusual and rare for me. I think most of my business would be done in the 2.5 down to, you know, 0.1 range.
Okay, how many bets a week or a day would you? Is there an average figure you could come up with? Do you like to churn it around?
I have been more and more. I used to be more selective when I was concentrating on the top end of the market, just try and pick the eyes out of a card and maybe only have 3 to 4 bets maybe on a day, but have a good crack at them and try and keep the ball rolling that way. But now I find myself backing multiple horses a race, most races on the day, and at bigger odds. So that gets the turnover up. But that's also, as I said, I think where the edges are these days. They have tended to be a little bit wider in the market than they used to be.
Okay, do you have a bet?
Sorry?
No, carry on, sorry.
I was just going to say, as to the number of bets a week, yeah, so now covering 5 or 6 meetings a week, at least 10 bets at each, I'd say. So, yeah, that sort of ballpark.
Okay, right, the final part. We'll ask you to get down to the nitty-gritty. We've talked about you have you sort of quite a few bets a week. So is it all win-only, or do you sometimes bet each way? Each way, i.e. in the places. So I don't know what the terminology is in Australia.
90% plus win, I would suggest. If the place price, I have a sort of rule of thumb that if the place price is getting near my win price, my assessed win price, then I've definitely got to be having something on at the place as well. You'd just be silly not to. But, you know, there's no very little straight each way betting in Australia anymore. It's two separate markets, the win and place markets. So quarter odds in 8-horse fields, you can, and 3 places just doesn't happen. So, you know, the bad each way opportunities that might have existed in the past just don't happen.
So what, the bookmakers don't take bets like that anymore? You can't bet each way in an 8-horse race?
No. Well, you can take the place price, but it's not going to be a quarter of the odds.
Right, got you.
Not a sixth, yeah.
Okay, so do multiples or exotic bets ever come into the equation? Do you sometimes go for a row of houses?
I don't. Some friends of mine do. No, I try to keep it simple. The incremental gains of win betting seems to suit my approach. I've had some good multi wins in the past, but that was when I wasn't doing it professionally, I suppose, and was more happy to shoot for the stars with my pocket money rather than try and make a living.
Okay, so your main business now, is it done with bookmakers or the exchanges?
Leaning more to the exchange now, which is a new thing for me. And for all those reasons I mentioned earlier.
Have you delved with sort of setting bots or automation or anything like that on the?
No, but it's certainly something I'm going to be looking into in the future. A cousin of mine's been a pro punter for about 10 years, and he automates a lot of stuff, both in his analysis and his betting, and he has had good success with it. As I've sort of touched on, I'm a bit more old school, like to keep it a bit more hands-on in both the analysis side and the punting side. But I'm coming to the conclusion that I am probably leaving money on the table doing it that way. So it's that's certainly something, hopefully I'm not too old to learn, but something I'm going to be looking into, yes.
And do you get your head together with similarly minded professional punters? Do you like to all feather brains trust in the morning or the evening before racing?
Yes. Certainly my cousin for one, but I do, Twitter's not a bad resource. I've met some very smart people on Australian Racing Twitter, and a lot of people there are happy to chat and share information. As long as you don't let it cover your own thinking too much and you're not just blindly following people, no matter how smart they are, as long as you have the courage of your own convictions as well, I think that's very useful.
Okay, when you've priced up a race and you see a horse that's maybe a quarter of the price you made it, do you get stuck in and lay them?
Yes, sometimes. Something coming out a quarter of the price I've laid, it doesn't happen very often, but when it does, I will, yep, for sure.
Okay, now, you mentioned at the beginning that you also do a subscription service. So I assume that means tips or betting advices.
Yep.
Why?
Another income stream is the obvious answer. The service I'm currently with, the Mailbag, is also another avenue to share information with some very smart people. They have great form analysts, but also people who look at the horses in the mounting yard. And some of that late information I've found to be invaluable. It provides an income, but it also, I think, improves the quality of my work and pricing, having access to these guys to tap, both from a form perspective and from late information from the yard. That tightens my markets up significantly, I think, and it's a great resource to have.
Okay, something I was going to ask before and didn't. Do you get information? Are you interested in information from like contacts, jockeys, stables, that sort of thing? You know, the tips that fly around. Do you take any notice of it?
Try not to. I've over the years I've heard it all. I think trainers in particular, they're like punters. Some are good judges and some aren't. Just getting information from a trainer just for the sake of it being from a trainer isn't necessarily of much use to you. But if it's an astute trainer who knows how to set up a horse for the right race, then yes, that would certainly be worth knowing. Information from jockeys, no. Leave me out of that.
So you mentioned that the Mailbag is a group of you that get your heads together and then put the bets up. Does that take the pressure off that there's a few of you and somebody can always get the blame if it goes wrong?
Right, yes. In that sense, it takes the pressure off. There's a bit of collective responsibility, I suppose. But I've grown to enjoy subscription stuff and tipping, but it's a different pressure. You've got the responsibility of other people's money too, riding on it. And also you are being watched and judged. So if you're not prepared for that. It's not something you can do. But yeah, I like this group at the mailbag. Apart from the information sharing, yeah, it does. You can spread the burden a bit amongst the between us.
I was going to say the you sort of answered it there anyway. But if you're going through a bad run, does it not multiply the pressure terribly that you are putting these also people all around the country are losing money when you're losing money? Or are the bets not the bets that you would be having as your main income source?
No, well, they are now with this mailbag service. Absolutely, they are. Because we actually send them out via an app in the last 5 or 10 minutes. There might be some in the morning if we like a morning price, but then we'll top them up during the day. And it mirrors exactly what I'm doing, I found. So, no, if the people who are following you are losing, they can rest assured that I'm losing as well. So, if that's any comfort.
Some of the people don't think about the practicalities of being a professional punter. I'm assuming that if you go to the bank and ask for a loan to buy a car or a mortgage to buy a house, they sort of don't think, oh, you know, that's a valued investment. So what sort of problems have you had in that respect?
Well, I was probably lucky in that my wife and I bought this house while I still had a job, which got the mortgage anyway. So, and I've been able to meet the repayments since I've been punting, which is a tick for me, I suppose. But I haven't actually faced that. But I know my cousin, who I mentioned earlier, he took out a substantial mortgage and had to pay well over the odds in terms of interest to get it five or six years ago. So. Yep, that's fortunately something I haven't had to deal with personally. But it's if you're gonna be a punter or in any occupation like that, that's sort of low documentation, so we say, then that's a challenge you're gonna face.
You mentioned that you've got a wife, so she must be very understanding. Does it slip into home life if you're doing your cobblers?
It can, because I work from home, obviously. So if she happens to be here on a Saturday afternoon and things aren't going well, she's probably going to hear about it one way or the other. But, I was working in the industry when we met. So not that she's a massive racing fan herself, but she's known what I've liked from the day she's met me. So she's only got herself to blame, really.
And you tell me that you've seen some, well, as we all have, at a certain age, seen some monumental changes in the game.
I mean, yeah.
The obvious ones would be the betting exchanges, but anything else really?
Yeah, it was. I don't want to make this a nationalistic thing, but I think since the UK and Irish-based corporations started taking bookmaking businesses out over here, that the landscape changed for the worse. All the restrictions on punters that have been imposed in the last 8 or so years, I suppose, have come from them, because that wasn't really part of the Australian way of bookmaking prior to that. It's obviously a far more efficient way of making money for the bookmaker. And as they're allowed to get away with it, I can't really begrudge them doing it, but that was a big change. Yeah, I mean, the exchange is obviously the biggest, but that changed the culture of Australian wagering. You know, there was almost an unspoken agreement, not that it was open slather and anyone could get on for telephone numbers, no. Winners have always been played harder. But, you know, if a price was on the board or quoted, then, yeah, there's sort of a sense of honour about giving them a bet for a reasonable amount. So, you know, I know when the Paddy Power people took over at Sportsbet, you know, they were cutting people back to nothing, you know, to win $10 or something, you know, when they'd previously been getting on to win thousands. And it was quite a shock at first.
Okay. What do you expect to be or hope to be doing in 10 years' time? Still this?
A version of this, yes. Maybe, I don't know. I've joined with some other people in an attempt to expand and maybe take a little bit of the pressure off myself. But, I don't think I've gone back to university and become a lawyer or anything like that. I'm pretty sure it'll be racing related in one way or another.
Right, last two questions. The biggest lesson you have learnt since punting for a living?
Oh, okay, since punting for a living, biggest lesson. kind of a psychological one. Don't ever assume you've got the game beaten. I've had, you know, talked about losing runs, but I've had some very good winning runs. And I will say that whenever you think you've got the game beaten and this is going to last forever, that is when either the universe squares up with you or more likely you've allowed some complacency to creep in to your work, and you'll pay a hefty fine for that.
Okay, so finally, young people getting into it, they want to be like you. What's the single most important thing that a punter needs to remember to help them succeed, whether they're doing it for a living or whether they're just trying to make a few quid on the side?
It's discipline. I can't believe anyone, even recreational punters, chase it. It's just how... Anyone who's ever got into trouble with gambling, that's how they've done it, chasing their losses. You have a plan and stick to it religiously. If you're a professional and you're having frivolous bets, that's got to be coming out of your pocket money. It's certainly your bank must be protected at all times and sacrosanct.
Okay. Sound advice. Well, Mark Rodden, thank you very much for talking to us, and good luck.
Thank you very much, Simon. That was great.
Thank you.
Follow our top sporting brand ambassadors, Davy Russell, Sylvester D'Souza, and Ryan Sidebottom, for their exclusive news, views, and tips on all the major events, with blogs and vlogs at starsportsbet.co.uk, begambleaware.org. Over 18 only.